Right now it is time to bring in David Tarachuk. It's time for the Media Beat. David joins us on a Friday morning. David has a great website called themediabeat.us. He is also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief, and we welcome him in every Friday morning. Good morning, David.
Well, it's good to be reporting in again from the media capital of the world, Marshall. The media capital of the world is New York City, of course, never doubted. And here I am talking again once more wonderfully with the ever-incisive Marshall Miles. I don't know if your news calendar says the same thing as mine, Marshall, but perhaps I should be wishing you happy first day of Poetry Month.
Well, it's Poetry Month. It's an April Fool's Day, and to some people, it's also a first day of a new. It's also a first day of a new year.
That's right. All in one. Well, yeah, you know, more somberly though, it's also the week that the Ukraine war enters its sixth week. Extraordinary to take that in, but it's true. And the media this week have gotten seriously twisted about by events in that war. Even cautious news retailers like the PBS NewsHour, which, as you mentioned, I should emphasize in the spirit of full disclosure that I am a contributing special correspondent. I don't know what's so special about me, but that's my role at the PBS NewsHour and its weekend broadcasts. So I just say that in full disclosure, as I say. But its record this week was not so hot, in one regard at least. It said that this week's peace talks in the Ukraine-Russia conflict offered a pivotal change. That's the word that was used. And the BBC News, too, who are, you know, normally really careful, called it a major shift in the Russians' position at those peace talks. That doesn't look so true as we now end the week. I refer now to, as I have done for many years, to Lawrence Larry Friedman, who's the war studies eminence at King's College London. I've consulted him ever since covering the 1970s Arab-Israeli war and the consequent international oil crisis then. And he applied some wise analytical words to the Russians' public position this week. He said, it's not a ruse to say that they're concentrating on the Donbass area in the east. He was meaning, of course, when they suggested they were lessening their attacks on Kyiv, the capital, because he said all they're doing is facing the reality that that's all that they can do, pull back in Kiev and concentrate on the east. Russia, this is Larry's phrase, Russia is adjusting its goals to reality because war is always quite empirical. I guess that's true. And this, of course, was in light of the Ukrainians so effectively holding the Russians at bay around the capital. But, of course, as Larry and any other observer would always say, even retreat, if that's what the Russians are doing, in parts at least, retreat is not the same as surrender, far from it. And of course, it's always an opportunity for any military force to regroup, which is pretty much an opportunity that the Russians appear to be fully taking. And while the talks under Turkey's auspices in Turkey itself, they were briefly hailed as possibly offering some promise, but the Russians, of course, pressed on regardless in the east and the south, while possibly and probably only tactically and temporarily did lessen their efforts around Kyiv. But overall, everyone now is assuming full-fledged onslaught as just continuing now in a horrible, battering way. And it has been continuing. And as for the future, we just have to once again, I guess, try to read the runes for what's going on in Putin's mind. I mean, the easiest approach, I guess, is always to say that Putin is just lying all the time. And we can cite his denial that he was ever intending to invade 6 weeks ago. And of course, he just went right ahead and did it anyway. News outlets are now taking up very, I'm not sure credulously is the word, but enthusiastically taking up the White House briefings and crediting them as they claim that Putin is now even being kept in the dark himself by his own military chiefs. I mean, that's possible, I guess. The general intent from the Biden administration seems to be, as it does its messaging, seems to be suggesting that there are splits on the Russian side, or at a very minimum, a lack of understanding about what Putin is trying to do amongst his own high-ranking military people. In the propaganda dimension of this war, I guess, anyone can join in, and the Biden administration is taking the verbal lead internationally, you could say, while it's firmly disavowing any actual military engagement, of course, but it's joining in fully in the war of words. None of this can ever definitively guide us to Putin's intentions of the war, still less what he might eventually be prepared to settle for. But the propaganda does go on. That brings me to extraordinary reporting on the propaganda efforts, which are, you know, a vital part of any conflict. Time magazine's investigative correspondent Vera Berggruen has been making a huge deal this week of Ukraine's youngest ever cabinet member, the 31-year-old Mykhailo Fedorov, who's Minister for Digital Transformation. You'll know, of course, if you've been following this, that he's leading the Ukrainian government's quite remarkable online war against Russia. He's the one who also appealed to Elon Musk, the world's richest man, asking for a whole slew of Musk's trademark Starlink satellite dishes to improve Ukraine's internet coverage. And he got them. Truckloads of the Starlink satellite dishes trundled their way into Ukraine at the request of Mykhailo Fedorov. And with content, too, online, Fedorov is going beyond even his already well-established extraordinary success in helping President Zelensky win office in the first place as president. And now, during the war, he's recruited what's being called an IT army of over 300,000 volunteers. Many of them are workers in that vast network of tech companies that Ukraine boasts. And amongst the volunteers are, very importantly, a lot of cybersecurity specialists, too. They keep up both a barrage of anti-Russian messaging. Well, they're also in a super geeky way. They're working really hard at foiling Russian intrusions into Ukraine's systems. This IT army have proven to be pretty successful as fundraisers too, netting over $63 million for the Ukrainian military, much of it collected in cryptocurrencies. Time magazine presented all of this as very much an example of a heavy, lumbering military machine on one side, on the Russian side, versus sleek digital agility on the Ukrainian side. And the specific territory of the battlefield here is that of Telegram, the once very suspect messaging app. Telegram, of course, was originally an invention of a pair of Russian web geek brothers. And once, of course, it became a favorite for terrorists like ISIS as a messaging venue. Now it's a major venue for millions of people in both countries, Russia and Ukraine. In Fedorov's own words, though, Telegram is now Ukraine's own home turf. An interesting sporting analogy there, because they are winning in this particular dimension, at least. It's a considerable communications achievement we should record for them to dominate on this particular very valuable app. It's hard to underestimate its value, in fact. It's been downloaded more than 1 billion times. So that's the propaganda war.
You know, another piece of the propaganda war, and I've been sitting here, and whether it's true or not, I don't know. I hope it's true, is I've been watching for the past 5 weeks, now going on 6 weeks, Russia invading Ukraine and bombing and doing all this. And I've been saying to myself, you know, the Russian people don't really have any idea, most of them, especially in the outer lands, what's going on. To them, there's no war because there's no war on their turf. Well, there's an alleged strike that happened against a Russian fuel depot right on the Ukraine border. Now, Ukraine hasn't said anything about it, but if it's true, I think it's an extremely smart move by the Ukrainian military. They didn't pick a target that was residential. They picked an oil depot. Nobody was killed. And if it's true, I think it sends a message to Russians out on the hinterlands that, guess what? There is a war going on. I think the Ukrainians have played this game along with the internet and with all the different stories to a magnificent level. And if this is true, I think this will be another step in that.
Yeah, if true, it's remarkable. You're right. But the if true part of our assessments of what's going on all depends on the accessibility of information. Russia has done a pretty wholesale job of shutting down media operations that don't adhere to their own very strict and very onerous rules. You know perfectly well, don't you, that even to call what's going on in Ukraine a war is now a criminal offense in Russia, and you can be sent to jail for up to 15 years for doing that. It's made journalists extremely careful about their word choices as they're reporting that. So that particular attack by the Ukrainians, it's tactically very considered on the Ukrainians' part, I'm sure, as you say. But whether or not news of it will percolate very far in Russia is a very difficult question to answer, and the most likely answer is that not many people in Russia are going to hear about that. What's very interesting is the areas of and Telegram, I guess, is one of them areas of communication of modes that are shared between Russians and Ukrainians, so that even families who are, and there are many of them, who have members on both sides of the Russo-Ukraine border, they're discussing things with each other on the basis of completely different understandings of what's going on. The Russians are even members of the same family. We're finding instances of this online now are sticking to the claims that the Russian government, Putin's government, is putting out, that this is a limited military operation to get rid of Nazification, for heaven's sake, in Ukraine, a country which, by the way, has a Ukrainian Jewish president, and whose family was suffered terribly in the Holocaust. That's the official Russian line, and it's being adhered to by Russian members of binational families, while the Ukrainian members of the same family are pointing out what their reality on the ground is, and there's a lot of dispute and incredulity being expressed. The propaganda side taking that goes on in a war is being demonstrated even at this very intense interpersonal level of members of the same families. But propaganda on our side of the world continues too. Let's continue this propaganda theme. I'm wondering, Marshall, if you're familiar with a TV show called Just the News?
Yes.
you are. I thought yes. You might be. You don't miss much. It airs on the so-called Real America's Voice platform. But it would be perfectly understandable if you missed it. It's not exactly high profile. But this week, that was where Donald J. Trump, remember him?
Yeah.
He gave an interview to Just the News from Mar-a-Lago, where else? And he went back to an old theme, though it rang very odd this week and a bit tone deaf in the current context. He was, in fact, asking publicly for a favor from Vladimir Putin. Remember how in 2019 he asked a favor of Ukraine Zelensky?
Yes.
Infamously so. Well, he was at it again, this time hoping that Putin could provide dirt on, guess who, President Biden's son, Hunter, and, of course, the president himself, asking a favor of Putin. I mean, if you were to hold a worldwide opinion poll now to name the world's least popular individual, I think it could well be Vladimir Putin. But, of course, Donald Trump doesn't seem bothered by that in the depths of his obsession. That obsession, by the way, with overturning the result of the 2020 election is bringing to the the surface now a whole host of previously not so prominent participants in that effort to overturn the election, who are now fully in the glare of the spotlight. I mean, it ranges now from Supreme Court Justice's wife, Ginny Thomas, Clarence Thomas's wife, to a law professor who advised Trump on the details of this overturn effort. And it's in that professor's case that a federal judge in California has passed his very considered judgment that Trump probably did commit felonies in encouraging the overturning of the election. This is all widening out now from a January 6th Capitol riot investigation and looking more and more like a comprehensive roundup of high-ranking conspirators against democracy as a whole.
You know, getting back to him asking Putin for that favor, here's the whole crazy thing about it, and this is the difference between a previous administration and this administration. Hunter Biden is still under investigation, and the person leading that investigation was someone who was appointed by Donald Trump in his administration. President Joe Biden left that person in the office to handle the investigation. Joe Biden has stayed clear of the investigation. He claims his son's innocent, but the Justice Department is doing its job. Joe Biden has separated himself from that, and the news media in this country has finally decided to start covering the story simply because there are some other leaks. I'm just trying to compare the difference between this administration and the last administration. Joe Biden's son is being investigated, and he is not stepping in any way at all in the investigation that is ongoing with the Justice Department.
Yes, the word that Trump is so eager to throw around, witch hunt, is probably more indicative of what went on in the Trump administration than anything that goes on currently, either from the Biden administration itself or the Justice Department, which is being extremely careful about how it conducts its probes. And of course, the January 6th committee of the House of Representatives, that too is proceeding very, very carefully. Though, of course, now trying to bring in the full weight of the law, referring to the Justice Department, for instance, what the committee clearly sees as contempt of Congress by the people they are investigating, refusing to come along and give evidence as they're being subpoenaed, in essence, by the committee. The two members of the Trump administration currently in their crosshairs are Peter Navarro, the trade representative, and the former communications head. Also, the two of them refusing to come along. This represents contempt of Congress. It's being referred to the Justice Department as a matter of criminal contempt, and we wait to see if there are going to be any charges. But in terms of, you know, who's being flushed out by this process, It's getting ever closer to Trump himself, of course, as it inevitably would. I think if you're of a suspicious mind, then I think suspicious minds are very active when it comes to what was going on January 6th. But the rank of the people being investigated now is getting higher and higher, and now Trump himself is unsurprisingly. Coming into focus here. It's so resonant, speaking just as a reporter here, and so it's so resonant to see a fellow reporter, Washington Post's Bob Woodward, writing along with his colleague at the Post, Robert Costa, about an 8-hour gap in the White House telephone log for when President Trump was still just president on 6th of January. There's this extraordinary omission lasting for 8 hours of who the president was calling and for how long, and perhaps some indication sometimes you will get in these logs of what it was that they discussed. None of that, just a long, long gap. And there are inevitable echoes in that gap. And this is what I mean by a resonant echo. You go all the way back to the Nixon Watergate scandal when the White House tapes were found to have, very interestingly, a gap in them, too. Though in this case, it was only 18 minutes, but that, too, was reported so memorably by Bob Woodward and his then partner, of course, our old friend Carl Bernstein. But the resonances there are very hard to miss. I mean, that gap, that 18-minute gap, was infamously blamed on the president's hapless secretary, Rosemary Woods. I mean, who can be blamed now, I wonder, for an 8-hour gap in the presidential record here?
Before we leave, I want to talk about the world economy. Of course, we're releasing a million gallons of oil.
Barrels a day. Barrels of oil. It's an awful lot more gallons.
Yeah. And we're doing that. And
coming out of the National Reserve. Yeah. And I guess the attempt is to hold prices down, though it'll have to. It'll take some time to see if that's going to be effective. But the president's setting aside 180 days for this exercise. It's obviously a very determined effort.
And you add to that, Russia has put basically an ultimatum on gas and how they're going to pay for it. The Europeans are going to pay for it. And also going on at the same time, I think it starts today or tomorrow, is a virtual trade summit between the EU and China involved. And it's basically about Russia. I mean, we have some amazing things that are going on tied to this war in Ukraine when it comes to the global economy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the headlines you're getting in even quite sober and somber news venues is Putin's war destroying the world economy? I mean, it's one of those rhetorical questions that are in themselves unanswerable, but certainly we can see the ripple effect of this catastrophic war. And the measures taken off of the battlefield, not just on it, to take measures against Putin. The oil dispute is just one feature. But yes, the overall slowdown in economic activity, which is consequent on this, and we're seeing that even before the war broke out, but now the war is exaggerating those supply line problems, and Ukraine, of course, is famously the breadbasket for much of the world, supplying extraordinary amounts of food, both in Europe and further afield. Much of Africa is the beneficiary of Ukraine's vast grain surpluses that did exist, at least, are now very questionable. Yes, this is a war that, however limited big powers like the United States will try to make it, by not getting involved, not getting NATO involved, nonetheless, on the economic front, we are all going to be involved.
Well, I can tell you this, driving into work this morning, the price per gallon at the gas station in Sharon dropped another 10 cents. I think it's down to $4.05 a gallon, where it was just a matter of probably a week ago. I think it was $4.55 or $4.60 a gallon. But it's going to be very interesting to see how this world economy shakes down and where the country's EU, China, the United States, how this all works together, and see if Vladimir Putin's insight was unbelievably correct by bringing mayhem to the world, or if it was totally way off base, and that mayhem will come home to roost in Russia.
Yes, and keep a very careful eye on China's support or lack of support for Russia, and indeed powerful oil-rich countries like Saudi Arabia and their ambiguous position towards Russia, to put it at its most polite. We'll have to see how that goes, too.
Hey, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. We'll speak to you next week and see what happens in the next week in the world of press coverage of the events.
We will indeed.
Take care. David Tarachuk with the Media Beat. Of course, you can find David here at Robin Hood Radio at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand, click on the Media Beat, and also at his website, themediabeat.us.